Welcome to this edition of the Quill Report and Weekly Review. It's our opportunity for me, Dominic Aquila, and Paul Harrell to come and go over the top 10 articles that the Quill Report readers chose as they appeared on the Quill Report over the last week. And so we bring them to you a day before, normally, before they come out in the newsletter that you can get if you are signed up for the newsletters. And you can do that easily at theaquilareport.com, and you'll see a button there that you can just press and give your email, and you'll be on the newsletter list. So the top 10 articles come out hyperlinked and ready for discussion, as we like to say, for yourself, for small groups, for sharing with friends and the like. And so it's a delight to have you. So today's Monday, the 25th of September, and so tomorrow on the 26th, the articles will appear in your inbox. So we're glad to come forward here. Paul, we've got a good list of articles here today. I see some trends. We always look for, see if there are any trends here. There are a couple of things that I've noticed, so we'll highlight them as we go through these top 10.
Sounds good. You want me to start with number 10?
Yes, why don't you start with 10, 10 through 6. I'll do 5 through 1, and then we'll start.
That sounds good. All right, so number 10, last week we have a piece written by Zachary Garris, The Expectation of a New Covenant Sabbath. We also have this piece by John Stone Street on number 9, When is a Question Better Than an Answer? Coming in at number 8, we have William Wolfe writing how C.S. Lewis predicted the forced pronoun push and showed us how to respond. Number 7, we have Louise Perry. We Are Repaganizing is the title there. And then number 6, we have Ryan Beasy with this headline, Beautiful Gospel-Centered Ministry in the PCA.
Okay, then number 5 is Why I Am Not a Christian Nationalist by Samuel Say. Number 4, Is the Tide Turning on Religious Belief? And this by Jean Edward Veith. Number 3, 5 Lies of Our Anti-Christian Age. And this is a foreword to a book that was written by Kevin DeYoung for the book that titled 5 Lies of Our Christian Age by Rosaria Butterfield. And then number 2 is the article by Becca French. Ladies, don't beat your pastors with the rod of Titus 2. And then number 1 by Albert Mueller, The Train is Leaving the Station. And this is our number 1 article. And the subtitle of The Train is Leaving the Station is Andy Stanley's Departure from Biblical Christianity. And in this article, which number 1, it is not like we've not seen this coming. In the coming days, Andy Stanley is set to host an unconditional conference, that's in quotes, at a campus of North Point Community Church in Metro Atlanta area. And the website for the conference bills this as a 2-day premier event, especially designed for parents of LGBTQ plus children and ministry leaders. You will be equipped, refreshed, and inspired as you hear from leading communicators on topics that speak to your heart, soul, and mind, it promises. One statement stands out in this description. No matter what theological stance you hold, we invite you to listen, reflect, and learn as we approach this topic from a quieter middle space. So that's how the article opens by Mueller. He says this promise of a quieter middle space might appear attractive given the volatility of cultural discourse on the LGBTQ plus issues, and a conference designed to help parents of LGBTQ children and ministry leaders work through these issues in clearly biblical terms that would be a welcome development. But the advertising for the unconditional conference indicates clearly that this event is designed as a platform for normalizing the LGBTQ plus revolution while claiming that the conference represents the quieter middle space. In truth, there is no middle space on these issues. It is no longer plausible to claim that such middle space exists. And so even on the calendar for speakers, Mueller points out the scheduled speakers for the event include two men who are married to other men, at least according to the current civil law. Biographical background on speakers, Justin Lee and Brian Neitzel, indicates that both men are in what are now described as same-sex marriages. Lee is from well-known as a platform speaker who argues for the legitimacy of monogamous same-sex relationships. Neitzel presents seminars on restoring LGBTQ faith. Just to be clear, this is not the quiet middle space. So in this rest of the article, then Mueller evaluates what is going on here and the turn of events, especially as he focuses on Andy Stanley. He says, Andy Stanley, one of the most influential pastors in the United States, has been moving in this direction for years, often by suggestion and assertion, but clouded by confusion and the deliberate avoidance of clarity. Back in 2018, he called for the church to be unhitched from the Old Testament, arguing that the Old Testament should not be understood as the go-to source regarding any behavior in the church. Not lie with a male as with a woman, and so forth. So in this article, then Mueller is critiquing this movement, especially with Andy Stanley and his prominent name and the ministry that he's been having for so many years that has influenced many, and concerned that now the train has, in fact, left the station. He says that, to state the obvious, this is not what is advertised. He has been working in this direction for years now. Sadly, it looks like the train is about to leave the station, and that means away from historic biblical and evangelical Christianity. And so, Paul, this is something that, you know, has been on the agenda for, since we've been talking about here on the Aquila Report, definitely since 2018 with the Revoice Conference, and in different ways, different venues, different assertions, you know, it has manifested itself. And here we see it now with someone who had been sort of in the middle of the evangelical movement.
Yeah, you know, I've seen several videos and watching Andy Stanley go down this path. I think one of the ones that's the most recent in my memory is the one where he was trying to diminish the Bible in its entirety, and he was saying we just need to focus on the resurrection. We don't need to worry about the Old Testament, and you know, really the only thing in the New Testament we need to worry about is the resurrection and the historical justification for. I believe that's what the video was, and it was just listening to his reasoning. Then I was like, wow, this guy is. I mean, I thought the train had already, you know, left the station back then. But I like how Al Mueller writes that this is not just a misunderstanding at this point. This is a trajectory that points to the unconditional conference and two speakers married to married to other men on the platform. This is a clear and tragic departure from biblical Christianity. And so Albert Mueller here documenting this departure from biblical Christianity by Andy Stanley, and he's not the first to do it, and I dare say he will not be the last.
That's right. He won't. It's unfortunate, and we move to number two. Title, ladies, don't beat your pastors with the rod of Titus 2. Of course, that's the older women should teach younger women, that phrase in the Titus 2. This is by Becca French. She said, there is a growing trend among women's ministries in the church. It's not new. Actually, it's older than the flood, but it tends to recirculate every now and then in different seasons with different costumes. At its worst, it might be called Christian feminism. At best, you'll typically hear it as only women should be leading women. Its symptoms are a spirit, critical spirit, averseness to pastoral guidance, insistence on the prominence of women, and inaccurate use of Titus 2. All of this ends up creating disunity and demeaning the value and purpose of Christ for women in ministry. Sadly, Titus 2, which is full of wisdom and guidance, is being used as a weapon to chase pastors out of women's ministry when, in fact, Paul's aim was the exact opposite. So apparently she's picked up a trend that's been in and out of ministry over the years, that you have this back and forth between, the being under the model of pastors and elders in the church, and then that it be exclusively women. And so I think that's where this title and ministry come from. So obviously, Paul, since it's number two, it does raise, an issue. It obviously stirred the pot. So she goes on to say here, pastors aren't perfect. They will need gentle, winsome feedback, but they're not unaccountable. God is holding them to charge, being charge of the shepherds of the, to shepherd the flock, guarding them against unsound doctrine and teaching them sound doctrine, so that when you submit to your elders and pastors, you are submitting to the Lord. And so then this sort of exhortation that Becca gives, ladies, in an age where feminism is on the rise once more, even in the folds of the church, we need to check ourselves for sound doctrine. As we are we in alignment with the guidance of God's word? Are we fervently clinging to it rather than our own preferences? When we submit to the Lord, despite difficult or discouraging circumstances, there's great fruitfulness of joy available to us. Let us truly be Titus 2 women in every aspect of the passage, not just the ones that meet our preferences. So just a word of encouragement from a woman who sees their sister sometimes moving in different directions, and just urging them to understand Titus 2. And she does explain how she understands how you get to what Titus 2 and what Paul's saying, that and exhorting pastors and elders to care for the flock, for the older men to take their responsibility, for the older women to take theirs, the younger women, and so forth in chapter 2.
Yeah, I mean, you already mentioned it, you know, guarding against unsound doctrine. I mean, this is certainly a proof text for sound oversight, of elders, administering or exercising sound oversight over not just women's ministry, but all of the different ministries.
Yeah, and that's something that I think that she focuses on in this article as she arrives at the exhortation that she gives to women in terms of, let's make sure we understand where Titus 2 fits into the narrative. And so she goes through chapter 1 and then says, shows where there can be declension if the church doesn't watch itself, and then moves into chapter 2, and restates the proposition. Now, what about sound doctrine? Well, here, Titus, this is what you do. Tell the older men this, the younger men that, the older women this, the younger women, so forth. And he goes through the categories, and she's saying, let's just make sure we're seeing that the exhortation ultimately is to the leadership, the pastors and elders, to those various groups within the church, so they can be equipped. So just a helpful guidance that Becca French gives. Number 3 is from Kevin DeYoung, 5 Lies of Our Anti-Christian Age. As I said, just going through this before, this is the latest book written by Rosaria Butterfield, and this is the foreword. It was written by Kevin DeYoung in it, and what he is giving in the foreword is sort of a preview of what Rosaria Butterfield covers in the book, and basically setting in the context of spiritual warfare. And he starts out, the devil is a liar, and not only just an old liar, a very good one. He normally avoids direct assaults. He prefers deceit and misdirection. Think of the snake in the Garden of Eden, merely suggesting that God's word might not be fully trustworthy. The devil specializes in traps and snares. He masquerades as an angel of light. He blinds the minds of unbelievers. Our enemy, that ancient serpent who is called the devil and Satan, is wicked, tricksy, and false. He is the father of lies. So that sets up in this foreword in the book that is just printed out for us here, that the devil is then the father of lies and the one who perverts things. So he says there is a war raging between good and evil in the world. And though we might prefer the conflict be fought somewhere else, we don't get to pick the times in which we live. The front lines today are battles over sex, gender, and identity. And I think just that line, Paul, that again, as we've said, just as we've been doing this podcast, how often you and I have come with these articles and talked about the battles. We just talked about what's going on with Annalise Stanley. And here it is in that statement. So that there's almost like there's something that comes, they come in packages, you know, for this period of time, and then and we exhaust it, and then we Satan finds another thing and he exhausts that. And so right now it's the sex, gender, and identity that we have here. And so just a few things that he talks about. He says with regard to the devil, the devil says to us, if God is a God of love, how can he judge? You have nothing to fear if you sin. So that's one of the lies that it's going to be covered. When the devil, when the evil one bids us to walk in resentment and bitterness with our brothers and sisters, we will not follow because our feet are fitted with the gospel of peace. When the devil comes with his enticements to sin, we will take up the shield of faith and will choose, like Moses, to be mistreated with his people. When Satan tries to convince us that God is unwilling to save us or unable to change us, we will trust in the name of the Lord. When Satan tells us that we are hopeless, sanctification is hopeless, and that the endurance is hopeless, that we will strike back with the war with the sword of the Spirit. No, Satan, there is no condemnation for those who are in Christ Jesus. So he goes on like this and ends up by saying, five lies our anti-Christian age has everything to do with the armor of God, because this book is a book about truth. Truth that you may have never heard, truth that you may have forgotten, or truth you already know, but you have not dared to embrace. Don't follow the great dragon. That's what this book is about. He has already been defeated. Follow the one who is truth. Listen to him, love him, learn from him. Do not fall for the lies of our age. Stand your ground. So very encouraging. So that sort of whets your appetite also for this book. It's just out now, so you may want to look at it. We'll probably have some reviews of this book as, you know, as more and more people begin to read it. But this is a good forward to let us know what's coming up. Be watchful, Paul, about the buying into the lies of Satan. He's very wily about how he does that. You know?
Yeah, that's really good. And I know there are other books out there about, you know, different lies and stuff. And they may have been written by Rosaria. I don't know. I can't remember specifically, but it's such a good format to just call out the lies, you know, and by doing that, you get to the truth of the matter. This is the second article in 2 weeks having to do with five lies of our anti-Christian age. There was a book review last week about this book. And so now we have the second mention of it. This is the foreword written by Kevin DeYoung, and it is excellent. And I cannot wait to read this book if given the opportunity. So
great. I agree with that. Okay, now number four, Jean Edward Veith has written, is the tide turning on religious belief? Now, that's an interesting title, because one of the things he is going to point out here in terms of the history, and there's another one, we get to the article on paganization that's going on, both of them really tread on this issue of, you know, we tend to look at things in a microcosm of what's happening now. So you have the Gallup polls, you have other kinds of polls that, you know, give us a snapshot of what people are thinking, what culture's thinking. And then there people also do the same thing with the church. And we've had articles here recently, you know, that the de-Christianizing or the deconstruction of the faith or deconversion that has been going on. And that seems like it's you know, if you look all these articles, you think this is a massive event and, you know, maybe has more people involved than we believe. So people begin to start to write the obituary for the church. Oh, well, the church has lost its relevance. It's no longer doing what it should. It's forgotten its mission. So in this article, Dr. Reith, because the tide turning, he says, we see something happening. And he refers to a book by Justin Brierley, Brierley, a new book, The Surprising Rebirth of Belief in God. So this is just out. So it's another type of book review. In this book, he says, I make a bold proposition that Matthew Arnold's long withdrawing sea of faith, he gave an example from Matthew Arnold about seeing the tide goes out, and but in time, it God comes back in. And so using that analogy, he says, I'm seeing that withdrawing sea of faith is beginning to reach its farthest limits, and now we may see the tide coming of faith coming rushing back in again over our lifetime. And so in time when church attendance and affiliation in the United States are plummeting, a phenomenon called as in the title of the book, the great dechurching, that is a bold proposition indeed. Nevertheless, Brierley sees the tide turning in the failure of the new atheist, and in a new openness to faith that he sees emerging in contemporary thought. And he goes on picking up on what Brierley says in his book to actually talk about it. So he mentions, what is this new atheism? And he talks about the four horsemen of the apocalypse. And these four were Sam Harris, who was author of The End of Faith. And of course, Sam used to be a very active in the pastor in the church, and he abandoned and walked away. He's one of the first that had the phrase de-churching or deconstructing his faith. Philosopher Daniel Dennett, author of Breaking the Spell. Journalist Christopher Hitchens, author of God is Not Great. And then also biologist Richard Dawkins, author of The God Delusion. So these four books seem to have sort of picked up and become very prominent in a lot of the de-churching, deconstruction that has been taking place. They even refers to a rally that they had, a sort of a Woodstock type of rally for atheists, in which they actually chose a new name instead of saying, well, the word atheist doesn't have sort of a patina of ring. So they took the name The Brights. Maybe it's a spinoff of lights from the scripture. I don't know. But what he is basically saying in referring to Brierley is that the new atheism became a religion with high priests and sacred texts, science as an object of worship, naturalism as the creed, regular gatherings of believers, and then heretics and schisms. But the implosion of the new atheism, which is now Brierley observing that in this book, was more than just an ironic farce. It revealed an important fallacy. The movement exalted science as the replacement for religion. But whereas science can tell us about physical reality, it cannot be a guide to moral values, as the atheist scheme itself demonstrates. So the new atheism has had unintended consequences. So so as Brierley says, I thank God for Richard Dawkins. New atheism has revitalized the intellectual tradition of the Christian church in the West. So in this very good, long, and helpful review, Dr. Veith brings us a number of different things. And this is what I'm saying is going to be saying, if you look at the moral imperatives that exist, he says that he sees a new appreciation for the Bible in contemporary thought. The higher critical assumption that the Gospels were written long after the life of Christ, allowing for a long oral tradition and myth making, has been shot down by the discovery of early manuscripts and other evidence supporting their historicity. So the value of the Bible is also being rediscovered. Brierley discusses even the Jordan Peterson phenomenon, in which the Canadian psychologist has attracted a huge following with his videos discussing Bible stories, which he says are so deep they have no bottom, and which he presents as archetypes of life, sort of analogies or coming up, you know, for what life is all about. So in this article as well, he says, as the author is a great dechurching show, the decline in church attendance not necessarily the same as decline in religious belief. Only 4% of Americans describe themselves as atheists, a percentage that, for all of the efforts of the new atheist, has changed little over the years. The vast majority of the nones, that's N-O-N-E-S, still have religious beliefs of some kind. The book shows that even large numbers of Orthodox evangelical Christians have also stopped going to church. So one factor in dechurching by the church is by the church itself, and that is that the past decade of decline has seen the same decade in which the churches themselves, both mainline liberal Protestant and evangelical megachurches, have been reinventing themselves in accord with secularist culture. The casualties of this culture went looking for an alternative, but couldn't find one. So that he says part of the issue is the church itself begins to leave what is defined as historic Christianity. And as a result, they fall away. And so we take notice of that. And that's where that dechurching principle comes in. So what we need to say is that the crest of the new wave of Christianity had a trough that preceded it, Brierley observes. For discouraged Christians laboring in our present trough, this book offers encouragement that the tide is starting to turn. So excellent review of Brierley's book that I think is, I think it should be good reading to encourage us, the surprising rebirth of belief in God. So Paul, in, you know, one of the things you always, as I teach in church history, it's what appears to be a decline, maybe for a period of time because of some up and down issue within the life of people or the church, but there's always a resurgence. And what's happening is now is people have gotten tired of the de-churching and the deconversions and the negative side, and now are looking for something that is substantial. So here's a good book to really help us understand that.
Yeah, you know, it's interesting to think about these, you know, these atheists that he talks about and how they actually kind of inspired us to, you know, batten down the hatches, if you will, and created this resurgence of thought. And I also think just adding to that, and this may be, you know, a little bit of a rabbit trail. I think this is continuing, this resurgence, this belief in God is continuing because, not just because of atheism, but because the secular culture is becoming more and more wicked. And people are recognizing that. And I mean, when you have, and they're recognizing that, and honestly, ironically, many of these people are not atheists. They may, atheism is espoused by the regimes of the world, science and that sort of thing. But then when you see somebody like a Sam Smith literally dress up as the devil or mock human sacrifices, you know, witchcraft and music and American music on, in, you know, during these award shows, which has been going on now for a very, very long time, just getting more and more overt, sicker and sicker and sicker. That has the tendency to repulse people and scare them and really humble them to seek the one true God. And so that is also going on in the midst of this, you know, really good map of how we got where we are. So
that's right. Well, then the fifth article takes us in a little bit of a different direction, but it also reflects maybe some concerns that exist in the world as people evaluate it. Samuel Say, Why I Am Not a Christian Nationalist. As you recall, Samuel lives in Canada and he is originally from Ghana. We were unfamiliar with the term Christian nationalism until a couple of years ago. However, some people are demanding that we should agree in this ideology. Most of us never heard of the term until the media blamed Christian nationalism for the January 6th riot at the United States Capitol building in 21. The media attempted to make Christian nationalism synonymous with evangelicalism. That seemingly prompted all sorts of professing Christians to embrace the term. for what I read, there are at least four or five different kinds of Christian nationalists of different stripes or different definitions. If the term was older than 2 years in the mainstream culture, I would probably think differently, but I don't think it's worth fighting for a relatively new word with so many connotations. It's what I like to say, when you have something new and it's ill-defined, it's like nailing Jell-O to the wall. You know, just it doesn't happen. So Samuel, in his article, then talks about different aspects of it. He'd written an article a couple of weeks ago that we also was in the top 10 of the Aquila Report, talking about why he's not a kinist, which is, seems to be connected with so at least some versions of Christian nationalism. So the point that he gets to here is at the end is this: it is not the church's responsibility to punish unbelievers, talking about the bringing the law, Old Testament law, to bear on political issues today and society. That responsibility belongs to Christ. He will punish unbelievers when he fulfills his kingdom in the new earth. Until then, however, his kingdom isn't of this world. This doesn't mean that we should believe in the myth of neutrality. There's no such thing as religious neutrality, a neutral nation, for every nation's laws are primarily influenced by one religion. From its founding and for most of its existence, American law was primarily influenced by Christianity. Now, however, America's laws are primarily influenced by postmodernism or secular paganism. That's actually why freedom of religion is necessary. It protects minority religions from persecution by official religions. For example, what do Christian nationalists say to persecuted Christians in northern Nigeria? Do they have a right to the freedom of religion? What arguments should Christian organizations like Alliance Defending Freedom International make to defend them from persecution? If we support blasphemy laws for unbelievers, what legal basis do we have to fight blasphemy laws in Muslim nations for, you know, Christianity? So although I want America, Canada, and every nation in the world to be a Christian nation, there are just some reasons why I'm not a Christian nationalist in terms of how it's being defined at this point. So it's good, raises good points on this that probably also couches within it, and this whole Christian nationalism movement that's been taking place, the debate that has long been standing of, in what way does Christian thought, does Christian theology, and the ethical parts of Christianity impact and influence culture at any given point in time, and then to what extent should that be? So good questions to raise to an issue that is very prominent before us, at least in the broad evangelical sphere of things. And so, Paul, I know that we've chatted a couple of times. We've the reviews of Stephen Wolfe's book on Christian nationalism and so forth. And so I think it's going to be one of those things that rises up. We'll deal with it over a period of time, and then it will, you know, take decrease, and we'll see other things take its place. But right now, that's what's on the agenda.
Yeah, it certainly is. And amongst the ranks of Christian Twitter, I mean, you know, people are going back and forth a lot with this right now. But anytime I talk about this, my reaction is we're going to get called Christian nationalists anyway. I mean, there are points in this article where Samuel say, I mean, if a leftist read it, they would say you're a Christo-fascist. I mean, when he writes every Christian wants their nation to embrace Christian ethics, full stop, the left is going to say you're a Christian nationalist. And so, mm-hmm. I mean, I've been intrigued by this entire debate because I want to have it. I really do want to have it. I want to, you know, I want to make sure, you know, those that are, you know, if they're kinists and they're calling themselves Christian nationalists, would say, well, you know, we're going to separate those two out and say no. I mean, he mentions Stephen Wolfe and how he wrote his previous article. He references his previous article where he criticized Wolfe for being a soft kinist, if you will. And he did say in the article, even though Stephen Wolfe denies that. And then I read the other day where Stephen Wolfe, some of his philosophy, his Christian nationalism philosophy, has actually, according to what I read, if it was true, has led kinists out of kinism. So I'm honestly confused, and I think there is more debate on this to be had.
Yeah.
But there also, and I'm not saying Samuel Say is one of these people, but there does seem to be a resistance on some who are against Christian nationalism to want to sit down and kind of hash out the differences, to actually want to have the debate about historical Protestantism, you know, about how, you know, this we live in this world. A lot of people are waking up from this post-World War II era, this post-1960s era, where, you know, they're realizing, wait, we had blasphemy laws on the books as late as the 1930s in the States. And so then you come to this idea, and this is what I think people are realizing. He talks about freedom of religion and freedom of speech. That's why he says, I strongly disagree with Christian nationalists who reject freedom of religion and freedom of speech. Well, this is what I've come to realize. When the founding fathers were writing the First Amendment, in no way, shape, or form did they believe they were giving people the right to be pornographers and to distribute pornography. That was nowhere in their minds. And realizing that jurisprudence and these phony Supreme Court decisions have brought us to this point, and it's completely reshaped the way Christians are instructed to enact or interact with the government, you know. Mm-hmm. And so I think it's been educational for me going and actually reading and looking, you know, what the mainstream Protestant thought was, you know, a long time ago when it comes to civil magistrates. And I think people are rediscovering that, and they want, again, back to the first point I made in the other article, the evil, the things are getting so wicked that this is the reaction to the wickedness, is people are kind of going back to the drawing board and saying, okay, let's figure out how to fix this. So.
And this is long-term debate within the church, and going all the way back to Constantine, once Christianity was sort of recognized at least as one of the legal religions. And ever since then, the church has been debating, fussing with, tweaking this. So there's been no one set example. So we'll keep on doing that. And this is raising it. And also just one more comment on this. It's that just as we weren't ready in 2018 to debate and the sexual ethics issues that were brought about because of Revoice, but we learned, picked up, you know, we debated, talked, and studied, then things became clearer. So he points out correctly here that this concept of Christian nationalism, used at least as a phrase, is fairly new in our mix of vocabulary. And so people are still getting used to what does it really mean. And give it some time and we'll see it refined, and things will get clearer. And you'll see he said 2 years, maybe 3 years or so, within about 10 years, you probably won't even hear the word. We'll have moved on, as they say, but it is what it is right now. Okay, number six is Beautiful Gospel-Centered Ministry in the PCA. This is by Ryan Beasy. And he talks about old school confessional Presbyterians. Now, Paul, so this is Christian nationalism deals with the, you know, what's called taking place in culture in general. This one is dealing with what's happening in the church, especially in the Presbyterian brand of evangelicalism. So old school confessionalism, that old school is a specific reference to a period of history in the debate on how should the church view the place of a confession. So in Presbyterianism, the historical understanding was Westminster Confession of Faith and its catechisms, the larger and the shorter. And so there were guys who believed that we take they were called old school men, believed the confession as it was given because it captures the system of doctrine taught in the scriptures. While there was the new school approach, which was more that the confession was suggestive. So you have this debate has been going on between the old school, new school advocates. So Brian is speaking specifically about old school confessionalism because it is seen as more, not as hip or chic as and in terms of culture, the need for it to be more intentional. And the language that it uses to describe itself, so that communicates the goals of the church and the gospel and so forth. So that's the backdrop to some of that language. So language does shape the way people think, the article says, and heavily influences the judgments people make. George Orwell illustrates as well in 1984. We see in this secular culture, simply by adding the modifier affirming to a product, policy, or institution, it's easier to brand opponents of the policy, product, or institution as something of phobic. You can add homophobia and transphobia and so forth. So who would possibly be opposed to something that is affirming, and who could survive being labeled with some sort of phobic? Language manipulates the way people perceive issues and even groups. So that sets the stage, I think, very well for him basically encouraging his own tribe, so to speak, the old school confessionalist within the Presbyterian Church in America and any other church that would identify in such a way, about let's not be afraid to use certain language that brings what we believe into the light and freshens it up, but without giving up any of its distinctives. So not all labels are as neutral as the one that was used in an article he refers to here. If an elder is described as winsome, missional, outfacing, and or gospel-centered, where would we assume he falls in this taxonomy that has been provided earlier in the text? If a congregation tends to focus on, speak much about beauty and authenticity, where would you tend to assume it falls on that taxonomy, that is, in this meaning, in this jargon? So it's the importance of language that he's talking about and how we define ourselves. And it's better if a group can define itself instead of being defined, by others. So what Brian Beese is then talking about is that the Reformed faith is grand and we should talk about it like it is and use language that reflects that without having to give up anything of its foundational meaning and what it means to be an old school confessional Presbyterian. So it's a helpful call to not being afraid of sort of putting a new coat of paint on an old building to freshen it up, but you're not changing the structure and where its foundation.
Yeah, and I notice here that Ryan links to a video of himself. I guess this is from him on the floor of the 50th General Assembly. Assembly, right here, teaching Elder Ryan Beese. So, and I understand that Ryan. Correct me if I'm wrong here, Dominic, but you're going to be absent here in a couple of weeks from the Aquila Report, correct?
Correct. And I'll be teaching in Egypt for a couple of weeks. So we want to have the podcast. I don't want us to go 2 weeks without it. So as you were inferring.
Yeah. Me and Ryan Ryan Beese and I are going to try to hold down the fort while you're gone for a couple episodes.
So we're going to test on Sora. He'll be a guest host.
That's right.
For a while. We've never used a guest host before.
No, we've never. Really... Normally we have to, we try to figure out a way to do the show while you're in Egypt over the, with the time change and everything.
We have done it in the past this time, just because of the schedule. For that particular Monday, which would be October 8th, I wouldn't be able to do it that time. So we got caught in that scheduling issue. So anyway,
I'm not excited that you're not going to be able to do it, but I'm excited to get to.
No, and I think it's wonderful because it dawned on me as I was driving. I preach at a place about 90 miles away now on Sunday, so I'm driving down the road and thinking about. I have to tell Paul that. I'll be gone. And then all of a sudden, the idea came to me and I ran it up the flagpole and you saluted it. So there we go.
Well, and also we do need to tell the audience. So in a couple of weeks, I'm told, I know that you and I, Dominic, we're going to go on the on Ryan Beese's podcast here. We're going to record it, I think, this week sometime. His podcast called The Westminster Standard. And I think it's going to be released in a couple of weeks. But look forward for that. Coming out soon. So
what they say in the industry is cross-pollinization.
There you go. That's right.
Sounds really really wonderful, doesn't it?
Yeah.
Okay. Now, number seven here, I think, Paul, in this article, it sort of ties some of these loose ends, not really loose ends, but at least some of the definitional things we've been talking about by Louise Perry that showed up in First Things. We are repaganizing. And when I first saw that, I said, I wonder what this is all about. And it's a long article, but it is enthralling. And I'm just really excited about it because, I like it because she says some things I say in my lectures in history when I'm going through certain parts, of times in terms of what did Christianity do when it was growing, starting out as a nascent little 120 after Jesus ascended to heaven, but before Pentecost, there was just 120 gathered together, huddling in an upper room. And then the Holy Spirit comes. Jesus said, wait for the Spirit to come. He will give you power. And then you'll see that we'll start growing. But if you look at the whole mass of humanity and population that existed on the day of Pentecost, what it was like, I don't know what the numbers are. But someone just said that, by the way, that our population on the earth now has just gone over 8 billion. So that's amazing. And I think back in 1930, it was like 3 billion. So look at that. In just this short period of time, almost 100 years, we've increased by 5 billion people on the earth. So there weren't that many back in the days of the New Testament, the first century. So what's the point? The point is that something began to change. Christianity was being persecuted because it was so contrary. It was bringing light, and it was bringing a not only the gospel, but a Christian ethic with it. Talk about nationalism and everything. The Christian ethic was having such an effect that it was striking consciences of the community, of the majority population. So here she says, to mention abortion and infanticide in the same breath is a provocation. A majority of voters in Britain and America regard abortion as permissible in some circumstance, whereas very few are willing to say the same of infanticide, with some notable exceptions, as we'll see, that is in the article. But this distinction has not been made by all peoples at all times. And the anthropologist David F. Lancey describes the far more common pattern. And here's a quote from Lancey that I've referred to. Among the ancient Greeks and Romans, sickly, unattractive, or unwanted infants were exposed. And that's in quotes. That means they were taken out to the wilderness and they were left and exposed to the elements and to the wild animals and the like, or they are otherwise eliminated. The Chinese and Hindus of India have, since time immemorial, destroyed daughters at birth to open the way for a new pregnancy and a more desirable male offspring. The Japanese likened infanticide to thinning the rice plants in their paddies. Among foragers, such as the Inuit or the Jivaro, unwanted babies were left to nature to claim. So modern technologies such as ultrasound allow us to identify undesirable characteristics, for instance, the female sex or the Down syndrome, earlier than our ancestors could. But the most common reasons given by women seeking abortion today, poverty or fetal disability or simple unwantedness, were the same reasons given by mothers and fathers who killed their newborn infants in other times and places. Historical and anthropological inaccuracy therefore demand that we plot the acts of abortion and infanticide on a chronological continuum, since they have typically been performed for the same reasons and have been permitted in accordance with the same moral calculus. So it was the arrival of Christianity, she says, that disrupted the Romans' favored method of keeping reproduction in check. With laws against infanticide and then abortion imposed by Christian emperors from the late 4th century, Christians have always been unusually vehement in their disapproval of killing of infants, whether born or unborn, and their legal regime prevailed until the mid-20th century when we experienced a religious shift that will probably be understood by future historians as a second reformation. Christians are no longer in charge, and their prohibition of abortion, unlike their prohibition of infanticide, at least so far, is regarded by most pro-choice secularists as archaic, illogical, and misogynist. That's an interesting just a historical analogy. So what is saying in the Louis Perry is in this article is that so we went through all this period of time when the fourth, fifth, sixth century, their Christian principles began to take root, and so the Christianity in essence became legal. But the point is that people didn't necessarily leave their paganism. And most folks back then, the Gentile world, were pagans. Paul goes into Athens, remember, and he sees all these statues, he sees all these temples, and all the things that were being done in these temples were sexual promiscuity, homosexuality, infanticide, all the things that are gone. And that yet the gospel, the light of the gospel came into that particular point. So she goes on to say here, for instance, paganism lingered on both the countryside and the enclaves like Athens for decades, even centuries. Paganism endured a powerful evocative shaping force in the historical memory and imagination of the West. It persists both in a positive form, and that is wistful memories of, and attempts to recapture the beauty and freedom that ostensibly been lost in the suppression of paganism, and in the more negative form of a lingering anger and resentment toward the force that had supposedly defeated and suppressed it, namely Christianity. So the point here is that the gospel had its effect, and it came into the life of the church. She has one more quote here I just want to get here from early Christian in the probably second, third centuries, Lactantius summarized the pagan objection to the topsy-turviness. Why did Christ render himself so humble and weak that it was possible for him both to be despised by men and to be visited with punishment? Why did he suffer violence for those who are weak and mortal? Why did he repel the strength or avoid by his divine knowledge the hands of men? Why did he not at least in his very death reveal his majesty? So in his book, Dominion, a remarkable account of Christianity's enduring impact in the West, Tom Holland, who is the author of Dominion, tracks the development of the confusing preoccupation with weakness, humility. And he notes that though early Christianity might make the sign of the cross or illustrate the Gospels with stylized crosses, they would not for many centuries regard the crucifixion as an appropriate subject for vivid artistic representation. The manner of their Savior's death was not, to the Roman mind, so obscene and so human. As to be beneath mention. It was not until the fifth century that Christ began to be depicted in the moment of his death, and then never to in a show of agony. These Christs were imaged with calm expressions as a sculptor or bodybuilder, or more pertinently, a Roman god. So the point was that makes us think about Paul, and that the message of the cross, it says 1 Corinthians 1:18, is foolishness to the world because it doesn't make sense to talk about a God who is going to allow himself to die. That's weakness. He's capitulated to the strength as opposed to weakness. So in this says that while Christianity became more and more prominent externally, internally, people kept their paganism of some sort. And they would do it with their superstition, their knocking on wood, all the things that are considered part of paganism. And so it went underground, in essence, and hidden, but it was still being practiced. And now in these last, 50 years, we've seen a resurgence of paganism that has now become more obvious. So some of the things you just pointed out, Paul, in the last section, with overt actions, the cross-dressing, the the things that the growth of abortion or infanticide or even euthanasia, all those practices are now coming forward. But where'd they come from? They already were there. It's just they were sort of buried. And when if they were done, they were done very quietly and, in groups.
Yeah. And, and there's the argument that a lot of this paganism, if you really want to get to, specific deities, not just paganism in general, which you would define as something like an outlook on the world that is just different or not sacred, if you will, as that's what she writes. Smith and Eliot do not define paganism narrowly as an interest that entrails or in praying to Jupiter. Rather, they understand it as a fundamentally different outlook on the world and on the sacred. But, it's also basically just been repackaged from one civilization to the next, over and over and over again until we're here. I do find it interesting. He talks about T.S. Eliot she talks about T.S. Eliot someone named Smith. So Eliot's binary is the basis for a 2018 book on the legal historian Stephen Smith titled Pagans and Christians in the City. One might reasonably ask why our choices should be limited to these two options, to be pagans or to be Christians. If we fully abandon Christianity, so say the secular reformers, shouldn't that clear the way for some newer and better guiding philosophy? No, says Smith, because paganism never really went away, which makes its return all the easier. So anyway, and real quick, I do want to put this in. Gustav, I hope I'm pronouncing this right. So there's this painting, The Triumph of Christianity Over Paganism, Gustav Doré, I think is how I'm going to say the name, in which Christ and his sword-wielding angels descend from the sky and scatter the old gods. Even after the Christian emperors began to persecute pagans in earnest, Smith argues that paganism lingered on both the countryside and in the enclaves like Athens for decades, even centuries. So,
that's right. And it's still present. So, Christians, even we not careful, we use a superstition at the talk, afraid to walk under a ladder or black cat rocks in front of us, knocking on wood, crossing ourselves, seeing things that are more righteous or holy, places and symbols and that kind of thing, all of which are part of the, the sort of the magic, if you would, of paganism, because they attach to objects and practices like that. So it's a great article. This one is definitely one that people should read carefully and learn that what happens is that today what we're seeing is that old Rome is now come to bear, and it's the new Rome that's active in the world again today. So nothing has changed. It's just reshowing itself in a different way. Now, the same thing can be said of the number eight. This is by William Wolfe. How C.S. Lewis predicted the forced pronouns, and that's in quotes, the pronoun push, and showed us how to respond. And he talks about his book, part of the Narnia series, A Horse and His Boy. And he gives the background to that story. And if those of you have read the Narnia tales, you're familiar with it. If not, you should, to capture so much. But William Wolfe, in this article, he basically says, through the pen of Lewis and out of the mouth of a horse comes a lesson for us today. We should see, as Christians, talk slaves and foolish talk. That's exactly what his twisted pronouns are. As Christians, we can talk slaves and fool talks. And he's that quote right out of the what the horse himself says in one part of the book, The Horse and the Boy and His Boy. For that is exactly what we twisted pronouns are: the talk of slaves to gender ideology and the utterance of fools who go along with it. So Bree, which is the horse, also gets at another important aspect. So he's talking about what C.S. Lewis put into his Narnia tales, which are written back in the 1940s. Men who want to be referred to as she, her aren't women, whether they want to be or not. And just as Tisrock was never going to live forever, so too, no one can change their biological sex. Besides honoring God's creation order and refusing to speak lies, our refusal to honor gender madness with our modern version of may he live forever, close quote, is an exercise of our precious and all too often undervalued intellectual freedom. The use of cultural shibboleths, that is the symbols and signs of the time, is a sign of our ideologically captured mind and possibly worse, a darkened heart and damned soul. So let's let there be no more of this Southern jargon. He's not talking about the Southern here, but of the
in Narnia. He's talking about Narnia, the South, right? In Narnia.
Exactly. So just since we have a lot of Southerners here, I wanted to think that C.S. Lewis spoke against that, but he's talking about, right, the Narnia jargon. This gender jargon between us, brothers and sisters, we are free. We are the free country of the North, the land of the risen and reigning Jesus Christ. In all things, and particularly in our speech, we should humbly but firmly display our allegiance, not to the false gods of gender ideology, but to the one true God who created biological sex itself. In a day, an age full of confused and confusing speech, hearken to this wise and fictional horse and join him in speaking freely and forthrightly. So how did C.S. Lewis presciently speak of these things that are happening today? He already had it. He saw it coming and wrote it in this Narnia tale. It's wonderful thing that William Wolfe puts out for us.
Yeah, it is really good. I saw this. He tweeted about this. In this particular phrase, and then I didn't know he wrote the article, an article about it. I just saw kind of the context of this quote from the horse and his boy. That's the the specific book of the Narnia series, and it really is interesting. And you know, there's been articles on the Equal Report. Rosaria Butterfield again, said that she used to use gender pronouns, but now she doesn't anymore. You know, and she said why it was wrong, why it was sinful, and here we have William Wolfe saying, actually, you know, it's as if we're slaves if we go along with this nonsense, if we go along with this, essentially promoting lies. We don't need to do that. So this is a really good analogy. And anytime you're going to bring up the Chronicles of Narnia or Tolkien and Lord of the Rings, I'm all ears at that point. I'm teachable. I'm the most teachable when you can give me Lord of the Ring references.
That's
or
right.
C.S. Yeah. Lewis ones.
That's right. And by the way, it's the repaganizing issue again that we just saw with Louise Perry's article as well. Okay, number 9 is when a question is better than an answer. And here, this is from John Stone Street in Breakpoint. And he's talking about and giving a basic shout out to a book by Kochel with regard to how to speak in this world and into a world that with all the language that we've just been talking about. So first he says, first, what do you mean by that? The battle of ideas always tied up in a battle over the differential words, which is what we've been just been talking about, Paul. And thus viral in any conversation or clarity, the terms that are used. For example, the most important thing about clarity, same-sex marriage, is the definition of marriage. When the topic comes up, it's best to say, hold on, before we go too far and what kind of unions should be considered marriage, what do you mean by marriage? Okay, and so now you're getting the person to have to address definition and show where he or she would be coming from. And so in this book, he goes on with there are other questions. So instead of trying to answer everything first, ask provocative questions that cause questions that have to be answered before we go on, because otherwise we're really going to be talking past each other. So Greg Kuchel's was written to equip Christians. His book was written to dialogue from a confident and informed faith as a thank you for a gift. And you could even get one by writing Breakpoint and they'll send you a copy of Greg's book. So how to be, instead of trying to give an answer for everything, maybe the provocative question is the way to go to force there to be more definition. And I think that's a healthy fashion, Paul, that that we need to learn more of instead of assuming that everything's clear.
Yeah, I like the how do you know that to be true? That's a great question for sure to ask somebody. And because we do live in a culture where everybody thinks it's, you know, everybody kind of parrots something is true. And a lot of times it's just not. It's just total nonsense. So that's what I like.
Just a discussion. Let's make sure we understand the term, or just tell me how you understand the term. That would be helpful as well. Okay, and the last number 10, the expectation of a new covenant Sabbath by Zach Garris, and he's talking about the fourth commandment. The fourth commandment is of great controversy in modern church. Many Christians today generally ignore the Sabbath, and even many Reformed and Presbyterian ministers have moved far from a Sabbatarian position. Much has changed in the early days of America, evidenced by the words of Conrad Spies, a Presbyterian pastor in Virginia, who said in an 1801 newspaper article, Christians are generally agreed in the belief of a divine warrant for the observation of the Christian Sabbath. So this was not only with Presbyterians, but Anglicans, Methodists, Baptists, and most of what would be called within the broad spectrum of evangelicalism. So what he says is, what I would like to do in this article is argue that the Bible expects Sabbath practice to continue in the new covenant. In a subsequent article, I will respond to objections of Christian Sabbatarianism, which include objections that there's no evidence of the Sabbath day changing from Saturday to Sunday and so forth. To be clear, Christian Sabbatarianism generally consists of the following affirmations. The fourth commandment has a moral component, not just a ceremonial one. The day has been changed from the seventh to the first of the week because of Christ's resurrection. The day should be devoted to the worship of God, not employment or recreations. So the expectation of the Sabbath for the new covenant is basically his theme. So while the fourth commandment is not restated in the New Testament, as he says, by the way, you won't find a restatement of the first three commandments either, in terms of themselves being restated. The principle, of course, principles are there. So the Sabbath command, he says, is broadly concerns the regulation of time with the requirements of God's people, and then devote one entire day to restful worship. So he goes through a number of propositions in this article that are very telling, very well done. First, the entire Ten Commandments are the foundation of God's law. Second, the weekly Sabbath command is rooted in creation. Third, the weekly Sabbath is an important part of life as God's redeemed. Fourth, the Sabbath command is required for the regulation of weekly worship. Fifth, the Sabbath was primarily about worship, not idle rest, and such regular worship for man's spiritual good. And so he goes on to make, you know, other assertions such as that. So very helpful article to help us understand the concept of Sabbath, that it's that there's no place where God says we've moved from 10 to 9 commandments. So how do we understand all 10 in there as God intended for them to be practiced in our lives?
Yeah, he quotes Isaiah 66:22-23, for as the new heavens and the new earth that I shall remain before me, says the Lord, so shall your offspring and your name remain from new moon to new moon and from Sabbath to Sabbath. All flesh shall come to worship before me, declares the Lord, end quote. And then he says, this passage speaks of all flesh, a reference to all humans that includes the Gentiles, all mankind. That the Sabbath continues in the new heavens and earth indicates that the Sabbath did not end with the resurrection of Christ. Well, so, I mean, the Sabbath happening in the new heavens and the new earth, what are we going to do the other 6 days, Dominic? That's my question to you, sir.
Well, he's going to answer that question in his follow-up article, so I won't.
Okay, there you go.
How's that for escapism?
No, I like it. Put it on him.
Well, remember, labor is also a creation ordinance as a Sabbath. And so we will be living in new heavens and earth. And as Adam was placed in the garden to care for it, so we will this earth will be renovated so that we'll it'll be suitable for our existence, and we will be busy on it as Adam was in the garden.
I like it. Okay. Sounds good.
Until he changes our mind, that's what we're sticking with, right?
All right. That sounds good to me.
Okay. Well, Paul, it's been a great series of articles here. And so we're delighted that you could be a part of the Aquila Report and Weekly Review for September 25. And tomorrow, the 26th September, you receive these articles that we've been discussing, hyperlinked, ready for you to click on and to read and to ponder. Please feel free to forward the email to friends and family to use with your small group, your Bible study, your Sunday school classroom, just your one-to-one meetings with people. We just appreciate so much being able to bring this ministry of the Aquila Report to you, as well as the top 10 articles that your fellow readers have chosen. And so until the next time, for me will be 2-3 weeks later, we'll see. But you be here next week and the following, and we'll even with a guest substitute here, it'll be a good and moving thing for the Aquila Report. So until then, the Lord bless you.